Welcome, O Fellowship of Fiends, to The Fear is the Fire That Lights the Heart, a humble podcast where we delve into the darkness that dwells beyond the edges of genre. Each episode, we're going to gather up a round table of writers, editors, and publishers to discuss the most beloved of genres, horror. Today, we discuss that unsettling village that lay nestled in the woods, Folkhor. Witches and cunning folk, cults and taboo magic and blood, spit, and sorrow, all things that crawl under the skin and keep us up at night. I'm your host, Paul Jessup, author of the book Glass House, a cosmic horror haunted house novel, and the new short story collection, The Skinless Man Counts to Five and Other Tales of the Macabre. You can check these out at pauljessup.com. Joining us on our third episode are some of the best writers and editors working in the horror genre today. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Rowan, and I write at theharvestmadereads.com, a blog about folklore.
My name is Dina, and I love horror, and I review horror books and sometimes movies and make horror art. And I'm Mother Superior on Blue Sky.
And finally, I'm Premi Mohammed. I am not an expert, but I like to write horror, and I'm a particular fan of folk horror.
Yep, I think we all are here. So I'm going to start us off. We'll just go very simple. How do you define folk horror? let's hear. Premi, would you like to start, since you do have a class coming up about this thing?
Yeah, it's. I ended up doing a lot of research about this, actually, which sometimes kind of knocks the horror out of things and sometimes doesn't. But I also gave a talk about it in October for the Get Lit conference in Calgary. And basically, folk horror is a type of horror which involves both an in-group and an out-group, where the landscape is often the source of the horror and the isolation. And also, I learned a new term, which is called topophobia, which is the effect of the landscape on the psyche. So that is always a component of folk horror. But basically, as far as I can tell, it's kind of defined more by what's already out there categorically, and you know, us being able to put various pieces of media into the folk horror box, then by having a definition and then applying it to other media.
Any agreements or disagreements?
Well, I think that sums it up pretty concisely. There's not actually nothing I need to add to that. I'll say that most of the time it takes place in rural settings, but I think we all are sort of familiar with the basic bones of the trope and what, you know, happens in it. So
I think there's, I don't know if that's all to it, though. I mean, I can see what you're saying about it being mostly having to do with the environment and the psychology of the environment affecting people.
And but also beliefs and values.
Yeah.
So that's also a big source. Beliefs, mm-hmm. values, and the importance of usually religion, symbology, and ritual. Ritual is a big thing.
Yeah. I think that's correct. Because when you look at the Wicker Man, especially, you've got that. But then when you look at what Mark Gatiss called the unholy trinity. I'm trying to think, I mean, with Witchfinder General, I mean, that goes in a different route, because then the environment itself isn't really part of it. Though when I look at that, Witchfinder General always feels like an odd one out to me. It doesn't feel like it fits with the rest of the ones he calls the unholy trinity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, for me, folklore is really about the kind of the terrors that come from this shared cultural history of a community. Sometimes the culture is still living, that's preserved by people who haven't fully assimilated into kind of modern or mainstream culture. But sometimes the culture only exists as a memory that is haunting the landscape or haunting these relics, you know, that you find in the landscape. I don't disagree with anything anyone said so far. I usually tend to take like a pretty generous view of what counts as folk horror. So yeah, I think I like topophobia. That's a great term.
Right. And the thing is that it's so varied and open to interpretation, too, that There's a lot of movies that I would consider folk horror that I think would be open, you know, for argument or debate. And I don't know if it's so much that there's a set of rules that must apply to it as like the feeling for me, where, you know, you get that particular sense of the scenery playing a part and being so important, and the culture and the people, but also the general unease of being feeling like, you know, there's an outsider that's stumbled upon this secret, whatever the secret may be, you know.
Well, that's that I'm thinking about too is like the topography thing has got me. It's really interesting. It just reminds me of the whole psychology environment thing that Jeff Vandermeer has talked about in the past. I mean, there's like a specific word for it, but I can't remember off the top of my head. But something else that I've been thinking about, like when it comes to that, then where, because Kill List, everyone like talks about as being a folk horror movie, but the environment, does the environment play an important part in Kill List? I'm trying to think. Because it does, but it doesn't.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
Right.
A Field in England does, and Under the Earth it does. I don't know. Sorry.
No, it's a good question. I mean, it almost feels more like you know, people talk about the urban weird kind of in tangent with folk horror as being kind of adjacent but slightly different, where it's kind of focusing on the uncanny and the unnerving aspects of the urban environment and how the urban environment can also be kind of infused with this history and this culture that we kind of take for granted only exist in rural places. But you know, Kill List kind of has both, I think. It kind of contrasts that urban environment that they're, you know, taking this strange odyssey through, but they end up, you know, in the countryside. So, yeah, that's an interesting one.
Well, and with the urban weird too, I wonder if the modern aspect of it can also play include the technology. Because to me, some of the best folk horror things are the ones that use modern technology as a, I don't know, as a catalyst, and then it's the dichotomy between the old ways and the new ways, you know, like Candyman, or, and you would say that that's urban weird, but then there's ones like Ancient Images by Ramsey Campbell, where it's all about, you know, this
That's a good one.
quote unquote hidden film, or experimental film by Gemma Files. And I don't know where those would those be urban weird without even, you know, being called traditional folk horror, because to me they are, but I'm not a big folk horror expert.
Yeah, I
So
think
is that
everyone.
seriously a separate genre, or is it all sort of umbrellaed in the term folk horror?
Almost everyone I know thinks of experimental film as folk horror. I've never heard anyone
Yeah.
say that's it's probably one of the OG ones that before, I mean, that pretty much came out a little after Mark Gatiss's History of Horror and that sort of thing started making folk horror popular again. That was even before the documentary came out.
I would consider all of those folk horror, and I think that's actually pretty pervasive in a lot of folk horror is technology, because it does kind of represent the new and the modern world, and it kind of gives us this false sense of being able to manage or control the ancient forces, and you don't, it never works out, right? That's part of the tension between the old and the new. So I think it's totally. Personally, I totally think it counts.
Yeah, that's Nigel Neale's whole thing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's like yeah, like Stone Tapes, Quartermass Experiment, and all that stuff is basically, hey, pagan stuff, but with technology. Were you the one who sent me the? There was like an article somewhere about the chain of folklore. Somebody sent it to me a long time ago, like a blog post, I think. No, it might not have been you. Somebody, it's an interesting. Let me see if I can find it.
I probably read it when I was
Yeah.
doing my reading for this. It's the one that talks about kind of the three links or whatever, or the four links
Yeah, that's
that
it.
you need
Yes.
for
The
folk
four.
horror. Yeah.
Yeah, somebody sent
Yeah.
it to
Yeah, I
me
really
for
liked that
the
one. Yeah. That was useful when I was trying to do the talk for the conference.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the Adam Scovell who was the first kind of film scholar to outline the parameters of the genre, and it's the four links in the chain. So I find it really useful to kind of refer to.
Yeah, I think you did send that to me on Blue Sky like ages ago.
Oh, maybe, yeah,
Yeah.
maybe I suggest it because he wrote it as a conference paper and then a few years later expanded it into a book where he does more analysis of films that kind of fit into this canon of this new emerging subgenre.
Like, I mean, everyone knows films that are folkhorror films. And we've already talked about Gemma Fowle's experimental film, which is, one of the few books that are folkhorror. I mean, what else would you consider like short stories, novels, that sort of thing, part of the folkhorror canon? Because, I mean, or is it just too early a genre to actually have such a thing yet?
I have a
We're
lot.
both shaking our heads.
I have quite a lot that I would consider folkhorror. Get really important kind of books, especially from that original era, of the 70s. At the same time that these kind of foundational films were coming out, there were also interesting things happening in literature. Thomas Tryon's Harvest Home came out the same year as The Wicker Man, and it's exemplary folkhorror. It's got kind of everything that you would want. And getting a little bit later, there's a book called Maynard's House by Herman Raucher, and that one is great. And even something like Burnt Offerings, I would say, is kind of edging into folkhorror territory pretty strongly. And I've got tons of examples of newer books as well. That's I kind of am trying to stay tuned into the both the film and the book side of folkhorror. So I try to keep up with that.
Yeah, I'm extremely scared of most horror movies, so I don't watch them. I did see the original Wicker Man many thousands of years ago, so I'm less up on my film. But I think there's a lot being done in the short fiction space, and I'm particularly thinking of The Fiends in the Furrows anthologies that are so good, and so many of them try to get away from that kind of home counties horror. But I'm also interested in the intersection between folk horror and cosmic horror because there's so many works where they kind of smush up against each other. And the idea of the landscape contributing to the beliefs and the landscape being kind of where we're vulnerable because we rely on it to live, for agriculture or for bees or livestock or whatever. And the idea that keeps cropping up in folk horror of, the land remembers, the land carries our memories, the land holds religion and ritual, and where, cosmic horror goes like, oh, I love that. Let's play with that. So things like, the Willows, which is kind of the borderline between cosmic horror and folk horror, or what's it, Algernon Blackwood's like the Wendigo or the Dunwich Horror. Things where you cannot take the story and have it happen in a city or on an island or something like that. Things where the folk part of it is really essential. But I really love those Fiends in the Furrows anthologies. I think they're so good.
Yeah, there are a lot of short story compilations. There's also the Damnable Tales one by Richard Wells, which is really interesting. And there's a Walk in the Darker Wood that was put out a couple years ago. And there's so many short stories that it's kind of hard to even think of a couple of my favorites. But there's the old school ones like Ringing the Changes to Me by Eggman is just really creepy, and it pushes up against that cosmic horror again, like you were saying, Preemie, where I think there's an awesomeness, a thing, typically that's the under, I don't know if it's an underlying concept usually with all folk horror, but they're worshiping some god or there's some power, whether it's the land, whatever it is, that is sort of beyond the comprehension of most human beings. And there's a short story that I just wrote recently, The Black Lord, and it's complete cosmic horror by Colin Hinckley. But there's so many elements of folk horror. It takes place in a forest and all this other thing. And I don't know if you could even separate the various strands of it, that it's so intertwined that I think that's a good point to make, that there's a whole bunch of cosmic horror that sort of has infested folk horror and vice versa. Because it's so nature-based and so, you know, outside of the human experience.
Yeah, Arthur Macken's The White People, I think, is probably quintessential, like, cosmic horror, folk
yes.
horror mashup. And it's,
oh my
yes,
God.
Exactly.
Oh,
I read that
that's
at
a scary
way
one.
Of an age.
Me too, me too. And actually, that just made me think, too, The Great God Pan, which definitely folk and cosmic, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's it with Mackin and Pan? He just doesn't like
them. Oh my God, what is it with him?
Well, yeah, I was going to add The Ceremonies by T.E.D. Klein. That's one that has a really strong kind of folk element to it, but it's ultimately cosmic horror. And that was one of the first novels that I read when I kind of started getting into folk horror. So that's a really interesting one, I think.
Really, yeah, it's, I don't think I've heard of that one actually, so I'll have to read that.
Yeah,
sounds good.
He only wrote like two books and then kind of disappeared, so
yeah,
he's
kind of hard to track down.
Yeah, it's
that
hard to find
happens
copies. Yeah.
That happens like way too frequently, sadly.
Yeah, one thing I'm really interested in is moving those folk horror ideas and structures and tropes out of kind of the home counties, and whether it successfully works in other milieus. Like I would argue that one of my short stories, The Arrival of the New World, is folk horror, and it takes place in a rainforest, but it's still very much kind of the in-group that has all the knowledge and knows all the rituals and the rules, conflicting with and being pressed up forcibly against kind of the modern world, the outgroup, the invader that comes in and doesn't have any of that knowledge, and how they decide to take action to preserve their cultural background, she said diplomatically.
Yeah,
And
I
also
think,
the rainforest is involved, so giant snakes and giant bugs.
Of course. And that just sounds great. Sounds fantastic. I was also thinking too, like Manly Maid Wellman's Silver John stories. Those have a very like Appalachian folk horror kind of thing. The same with Old Gods of Appalachia, the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is also very cosmic horror, folk horror kind of thing.
Well, that makes me think of Revelator by Daryl Gregory. Has anybody read that? That's
yeah, that's
almost
so good.
Yeah.
And movie wise, Empedocle, that one I would say is definitely folk horror, Indonesian, I think, and it's really good.
Yeah. I would even argue that Satan Slaves Communion is folk horror in a way.
Yeah, I think so. Both of them, both that one and the sequel.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I've seen folk horror in a lot of different places that you wouldn't expect it. I have this drum that I keep kind of banging on about, where I think that a lot of stuff that gets categorized as Southern Gothic is actually, you know, it could also be called folk horror. I think a lot of weird Western stuff could also be folk horror. I mean,
absolutely, like The Wind.
Huh?
I said absolutely, like The Wind.
Yes, The Wind is so good. Or like Bone Tomahawk, you know, I think that most people would call that a weird Western, and I think it has a lot of folk horror aspects to it as well. I've even read stories that were set in space that I thought, you know, this this kind of has a lot of the same elements to it.
Actually, that'd be very interesting, like folk horror set in space. I think that would be one of the ideas I would keep coming to, is like it would make perfect sense in a generation ship, because they'd have to be an agrarian society. You know, they'd have to be able to have grow their own food and everything like that. They're going to be in there for that long. So wouldn't they, after so many generations, revert back to like the old ways, so to speak, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
One of those ideas. I'm surprised no one's done it yet. Probably has. I bet somebody's done it.
Okay, well, now we all have to write one.
Yes.
So
my friend keeps telling me to watch was it Silent Running? She
Oh, that's
tells
so
me that
good.
that one kind of has some potential there, because they are kind of doing some agriculture in on the spaceship, and but I haven't seen it, so I can't personally vouch for it.
I don't know if I'd call it for, because it doesn't have any of the others, the elements of it. It's got the agriculture, but and you know they kind of infighting amongst people and stuff, but yeah, there's none of the ritual or anything. I watched that when I was a kid because I was big into Star Wars. I'm like, ooh, another science fiction movie from the 70s. And I was like, what is this? And my parents were like, I don't think you should be watching this. I'm like, I'm watching it. So it's an interesting movie. I liked Silent Running, but I don't know if that would be folk horror any more than like Disney's Black Hole would be folk horror.
I like the idea of it being in space, though, and trying to, you're still able to keep some of those folk horror, like the links in the chain, though, because even if it's not agriculture, maybe it's like the life support system or something. It's something that is so important, so vital, and so out of the control of the people who are working with it, possibly. So farmers, right? They don't know if their crops are going to succeed, or they don't know if their animals are going to get sick. So that's the foundation of kind of that folk horror from like the 60s and 70s. Whereas in space, you've got, you think you've got control of these systems, maybe the agriculture, maybe the oxygen, stuff like that. But if it does start going wrong, you would still do anything to make it right. So in the movies from the 60s, 70s, they're like, okay, well, here's what we're going to do to make it right: human sacrifice. And in space, maybe they come up with something similar.
Especially population control.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
It's like the lottery
Oh,
meets
Ritual Running.
Silent Running. Yeah.
Yeah. The Lottery meets Silent Running. I'd watch that or
I would
read
watch
it.
that.
Yeah,
Sounds
easily.
great.
Yeah.
Especially if it's generational, like you said, and then there's some people that have kept sort of the old beliefs and the old religions, and then, just how that would adapt and be modified or even die out. But, there'd still be a group of people that kept it up, and yeah, that would just be, there's a lot of potential there. I think
Yeah.
that's a good idea.
And that's exactly it, actually, is you always, for folk horror, that's what you need, the juxtaposition between the old beliefs and the new beliefs, or whatever other differences they've got. So like the rural versus the urban, it's probably a city person coming in as the outsider, in-group versus out-group, rich versus poor, carries the old beliefs or has converted to Christianity or atheism or something, and is coming in. So you need that juxtaposition to create the conflict for the story. Otherwise, nothing happens. So that could be how we do it on the generation ship, is the two factions of belief come into conflict.
Right.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, somebody write this, not me. I'm on
Yes,
deadline. Oh, you should write
I've got so much that I want to
it.
do. It's
No, it's, my agent
yeah.
will yell at me.
Somebody write this. Whoever's listening to this podcast, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have just
Here, sign
volunteered
you.
you. You're the
Yeah.
sacrifice.
Please, we want to read it.
Yeah. We've just incorporated ourselves into the story. They'll write us in, and then we'll be some of the first casualties.
Sacrifices.
The first on the pyre.
It's interesting too, because I got into an argument with somebody like on Twitter, like before it like got really, really bad. It was just mostly bad. And this person was going on, and there she was like a Star Trek fan since the original Star Trek and stuff. And she told me that there would be no religion in space, only atheists would be like the future is going to be atheists, and that's it, because religion's a bunch of superstition and we're going to evolve past it. I'm like, what? I don't think that's really a strange thing to say. I mean,
Yeah.
to me, I'm more interested in what could grow and evolve out of like whatever we have in space, like what we take
Well, and
with
even
us.
when you have that dynamic, it's still, I mean, the show Dances with Wolves was predominantly, that was one of the main issues of it. It's, you've started, well, first of all, has anyone seen that?
It's been too long ago since I've seen it. I don't remember.
remember the
What
movie.
was it called? No, not Dances with Wolves. I'm sorry. Raised by Wolves.
Oh, I heard about that and I wanted to
I've
see it.
seen it. Yeah, it was really fascinating because it was all about this technologically advanced society. Well, it's really convoluted. It's a very large sort of story, and then it got canceled, so it kind of just stopped. But it was fascinating because it dealt with just technology and a culture where there were these two factions, one very atheistic and one sort of keeping the old ways, and then you introduce cyborgs and androids, and how do they cope with it, and then just the genesis and the birth of them, and they sort of discover religion in a way as they humanize. And it was really fascinating because it brought up all these questions about what is reality, what is religion, what is humanity, what does it mean to be human. So I just think, yeah, it would carry over in some capacity. I think there would always be a faction of people that took comfort in some form of religion, no matter how you tried to ostracize it.
That was a big part of Battlestar Galactica too, all those themes that you just said, about religion and what it means to be human and what is reality. So it I yeah, it's interesting. I think even in sci-fi, even in this kind of futuristic society, you're never gonna outgrow the need for spirituality.
I agree. And because I'm so incredibly cool, I'm reading a book about Gnosticism right now, and kind of the way it was declared a heresy by the church. And basically the thinking being, religion has to serve two functions, which is one is kind of a societal binding, because the root word is from, the Latin for binding together. So it's supposed to give people a set of shared values and morals that keeps society more or less cohesive. But the second is to satisfy the extremely primal human need to commune with the divine, which we are never going to get rid of, no matter how far away from the divine we get. So their thinking was Gnosticism kind of arose because of the second thing, not the first thing. So the second thing is, sects and heresies and cults and new religions don't arise unless there happens to be a gap in what already exists. So I feel like in the future, in space, in new settlements, in new planets, anything like that, we are never going to be able to fill that gap. And people are always going to lack certainty and knowledge about, the so-called divine or their place in the universe. And religion or something similar is always going to fill that, or something weird is going to evolve to fill it, like on our putative generation ship that we are all going to write about.
Yes.
Someday. Someday.
I really need to leave the house more. I'm sitting at home reading weird books about religion.
I
Sounds
don't think
great.
that's winning at life.
It is really interesting.
It sounds interesting.
Yeah, the Gnostics are really an interesting group of people,
They're
like
so
spiritually.
interesting.
They are, yeah.
I got into it because I had been reading a book about the end of the world, which, again, as one does.
Yeah.
And they just had a couple of throwaway lines about what the Gnostics thought. And I was like, well, now I have to read about that. Again, it's too bad I'm on deadline. I'm very sorry to all my editors, but I have to chase this rabbit hole of religious weirdos.
It's interesting though, you know. That's you can say it's research for whatever's going to be next after those deadline books. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then you have the fact that there's always going to be humans that sort of take advantage of that too, and for their own, whether it's their own divinity or their own want of power. But it's interesting to me that now, even with atheism being more and more common, there's still sort of these atheistic mystics. I know we're totally off topic now, but
No, I
it's
think that it
fascinating
all
to
ties
me.
in.
Yeah.
Right. And you even bring in chaos magic, and I really feel that in the future, if that gets more popular with people, there's going to be some folklore that's based on, the tenets of and sort of the idea of chaos magic, because it's the next evolution sort of religion, if you can, call it that in a way. It's like it's the branch of technology and religion sort of coming together, and people realizing the potential that lies in the internet capacity for quote unquote magical thinking. So
I may have already written a short story like that, actually.
Ooh.
Yes, magic it and stuff. Yeah.
But yeah. this is exactly where it ties back into folk horror, because again, you have that in-group defending their values and beliefs because they're important to them. Because anything that challenges it is a challenge to societal cohesion. So whatever that belief is, you know, whether it's let's set the outsider on fire or we have to make a sacrifice of fruit every year, they are going to cling to that because nothing from outside should be allowed to replace it, you know, because you value what you value, you love what you love. And I think that's very much kind of the basis of folk horror.
That's interesting because, I mean, talking about that one woman who was talking about like space will be full of atheists. I mean, that could be the predominant religion that's being challenged by, because she was angry that there would be a religion in space.
Oh,
like
no.
she was like really just like, no, though, like she was like getting very angry. Like I ended up blocking her because like, what? But I mean, that brings me back to this thought of like, what if they see like something, what if they're like that? They see like some sort of either neo-paganism, Wiccanism, anything like that as an affront to their rationality. Like that could also create a similar Wicker Man style, like, you know, wedge between the two groups and everything.
Yeah, I agree. The constant idea of social immunity, of, you know, having to encircle and surround and remove bad elements before they infect the rest of the community. That's a very powerful desire because it's a very powerful fear.
Yeah. Well, building off of that, because, you know, a lot of things that you're all saying are kind of making me think a little bit about the current moment that we're in, you know, and what needs that we have now in our society and, you know, gaps that need to be filled. And thinking about the current kind of explosion and popularity of folk horror. And so this could potentially be a thorny question, you know, but I just wonder if any of you kind of have opinions about what it is about this current moment that makes more people interested in these kinds of stories and these kinds of themes, because that's something that I'm always thinking about, like, why now? What is it that's really resonating with us about these types of stories in this day and age?
Well, I think we can all agree that nature is being destroyed. And I think that that is part of it, is that we realize the fragility of it all. And you have these people who have this reverence for nature and this respect for this just life in a way that I think technology has sort of, you know, placed less importance on that. And then I think there's a lot of people that feel sort of like they're the outsider, even though they'd be surprised to know that they're absolutely not alone in thinking that. And I think those two things are really powerful themes that run through folk horror, where you've got this person in a situation, you know, like you guys were elaborating on, where they're butting heads or experiencing a place foreign to them. And I think that with how disconnected we all seem from one another, I think that it's comforting for people to read about that and to sort of feel, you know, well, it could be a lot worse. Like there could be a cult banging on my door, you know, wanting to sacrifice me.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, I absolutely agree with Stina. And I think I see kind of the same two things, like why so popular now? I think so. One is definitely that kind of disconnect from our, you know, from the land, but also our awareness of our lack of control about it all. You know, we even saw this at the start of the COVID pandemic, was we're very, very vulnerable to any changes in our, you know, supplies. With everything being just in time, we have no control over, you know, what we eat or what we buy or where we can get things. And we don't have like a backup or a safety net if some of those things fail. I think psychologically, we've all just realized that we're basically, you know, 12th century farmers waiting for our next failed crop. And if two of them fail in a row, everybody's going to die. So I think there's kind of a primal fear at that lack of control that people maybe don't realize, but I think they're responding to. And then secondly, kind of like Stina said, this really strong perception of in-group and out-group again, which is being amplified by the internet, where we are able to find people that think a lot like us, but we're also being exposed to far more people, thousands, millions of people who don't think like us. And so we feel that our values are under attack. And we feel instinctively that the thing to do is not to listen to the other people, but to close ranks. So when we see that happening in folk horror, I think our first instinct is, good, burn that guy. He shouldn't have come to the island. He's an outsider and he's a threat. And everything is so black and white now without nuance, and that blackness and whiteness is kind of really prominently set up in folk horror. Like you know which side you're supposed to be on.
It's interesting thinking about that in regards to the Wicker Man, because like one of the reasons why I think a lot of people like it is because you're on the side of the villagers. Like most people, they watch it and they're like, oh, but the thing is, I feel sorry for Agent Howie the whole time. I feel that poor guy. But like, you kind of see their point.
Well, but he's also slightly insufferable.
That's it. He's kind of like, okay, yeah, all right. A cab, But it also does an interesting thing where like it does the normal cop movie tropes again and uses them against the audience so that we think we're going along for a specific route. Okay, he's there, he's going to do these things, and he's just acting like a regular hard-ass police officer. And it kind of just goes, well, no. And I think folk horror has it does do stuff like that a lot. Like I'm thinking of one, but well, I can't remember the name of it. It was like a Netflix original a while back. Not The Ritual. Gosh, I can't remember the name of it, but it's about a guy going to an island and they're like this whole weird religion that had like a Mother Earth thing, and it was like really kind of creepy. But
The
the whole like,
Apostle?
what's that? Yeah, that's it, The Apostle. Yes,
Okay.
that was it.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember. But it does like a similar thing, like a classic noir going to this place to like try and find out this stuff, and it also kind of turns it inside out. I think that might be another element of folk horror, is to take other like traditional story elements for things like the noir, the detective story, things like that, and just kind of play with it in an interesting way, like turn our expectations against us in a trick.
Oh, absolutely. And with what you were saying earlier too about the Wicker Man, that's kind of what I find so fascinating about Midsommar, because it puts you on the side of her at the end in a weird way. But then when you analyze it further, it's so not. She doesn't get a happy ending at all. She's now part of a cult, and these people are sort of terrible. But when you're caught up in that and in the relationship, and you're seeing this dynamic between her and her boyfriend, the whole time you're just like, all of these people are just awful, and she just wants some friends, and you're so happy for her that she finds these friends. And like I said, then you pause and you think about it, no. And I think that that's what makes that movie really unique. It's not one of my favorites even, but I respect it a lot because it sort of takes those tropes and subverts them a little bit in a way that was different than a lot of movies I see now.
Especially, it's interesting because I guess he was hired by a company to do a slasher film, and that's what it is, technically. When you think about it, he actually takes the rules of the slasher film and he just upends them. I mean, he's technically the final girl, but none of the deaths are shown on screen. You were shown the bodies afterwards, but like those are the key parts of most slashers, is you watch them die in terrific ways, and it plays with it much the way folk horror plays with other like horror elements and stuff, or noir and things like that. Yeah, again, it's not one of my favorites either, but it does some interesting things, I think.
Yeah, I
Yeah,
did
that's
not
interesting.
see
I
it,
hadn't heard
so
that.
sorry. No, go on.
No, go on. I was just saying I hadn't heard that it was originally, going to be a slasher, or that was his intention. So I find that really interesting.
Some Swedish company paid him to make a slasher, and so like he just went his own way and did his thing with whatever that
That's great. Oh my God. A Swedish slasher. Yeah, I was just saying, I didn't see it, but as you guys were talking, I was like, oh, it's so nice that she found friends. Wait a minute. Sorry, wait, who are the friends? The friends aren't a murderous cult, are they?
A white supremacist murderous
Oh,
cult.
dear.
It's almost like he's saying, you really want to join that company on the weaker and the Wicker Man? This is what it means.
Yeah, exactly. There is, for me, the pull of a lot of folklore, and it doesn't apply to all folklore, but a lot of it that I really like, there is this kind of like desire repulsion kind of dynamic going on where you're like, oh, I want to go to there. I want to escape from this place where technology is constantly surveilling me and tracking my location at every single second and trying to sell me things, and where we can't trust each other because no, everyone's just looking out for themselves and kind of breaking the social contract. So I want to go outside of the system. I want to go off grid. I want to be a witch in the woods, by myself. And so there's a lot of that desire and that kind of fantasy escape element to it. But then at the same time that you realize how much of a trap it is, that is equally, that is also going to take you down a bad road. So you're kind of undone by your own desires in a way. And so I think that my favorite kind of folklore stories are the ones that do that, like The Wicker Man, where it kind of uses your own sympathies against you. It's great.
Yeah, I feel like sorry, and just what you were saying prompted me. It was either in that paper or that book or something else that I read or watched around that time, but the timing of those kind of earlier folk horror movies was not a coincidence. That was a response to basically people going back to the land, the hippies, like the hippie movement, the farmsteader movement, people going out of the cities and trying to reconnect to the land and extremely annoying the farmers and, the other people who had been on the land for centuries and did
Who
not
actually knew what they
appreciate,
were doing.
yeah, and did not appreciate the intrusion and, the conflict of that, again, the influx of people trying to get back to the land or have an experience with the land. And like you say, believing that it looks safe and good and better than their current tech-heavy modern lives is an illusion. And that's what sets the trap is folk horror, like visually, when you look at it, like it's so beautiful. It looks so idyllic and peaceful. The forest looks so nice and welcoming, and the fields are always, full of grain, and these animals look suspiciously healthy. And all of that is supposed to be the big appeal. But
And
exactly at that
community.
time, in like the 60s and 70s, that's what was happening, was people were going back to the land and discovering that it was like the worst ever. And that's why the BBC had to start putting out those like public safety advertisements about what to do.
Apaches.
Yeah, stuff like that. So
I think that
yeah,
was the
the timing is
documentary.
really interesting.
I think they talked about that in the what was it? The documentary,
Yeah, I was trying to remember the
Woodland's
name.
Dark and Days of the Witch.
Bewitched. Yeah, well, that's it. It's a wonderful title, but I can never
Yeah,
remember it for the life of me.
it was the whole counterculture movement that modern folk horror kind of came out of.
Yeah, which makes
Yeah.
it, and actually, I wonder if that's connected to the modern day too, because like,
Yeah.
I mean, there are some people going off grid, like van life, that kind of thing.
Tiny houses, hobby farms, that kind of
Trad
thing.
wives.
Trad wives, cottagecore.
Yeah,
All that stuff. I'm
exactly.
wondering if that's a part of it too, then.
Cottagecore is folk horror. It doesn't have to do anything else. Like, as you look at the Pinterest board and you're like, someone's gonna get sacrificed here.
I wrote a lot about that, the aesthetic, the rural aesthetic, and I mean, especially during the pandemic when everyone was isolating, and maybe not everyone is able to isolate in a place that's pretty or picturesque. Maybe you're in a tiny shoebox in a very urban environment, so it's natural to kind of, romanticize these images of, yes, let's go foraging for mushrooms in the forest. So I totally think it comes out of the same impulse. Sorry?
This is yeah, because all those mushrooms are totally safe to eat, and you don't need any knowledge.
Perfectly fine. perfectly fine.
Just use AI. I was going to say just buy an AI guidance book. You'll be fine. Be fine. Yeah. All mushrooms are edible once.
Yeah, I grew up in the rural Midwest as a kid, and so I know what that's like living out there. And it was actually, I really enjoyed it until I was in high school. And teenagers and 20 somethings, that's not a good place to be. No, like now I'd be fine. You know, I'd be perfectly happy living out in the middle of nowhere, and you know, it'd be fine. But yeah, that age now. Now, but I wouldn't be living off the land. I'd be having Amazon sending me my groceries. Like, screw that. I'm not going to have a garden. I have no green thumb. I died.
Unless you did a human sacrifice to ensure good crops.
Yeah, but there's not enough people out there in the rural communities. You'd run out of people real quickly.
Amazon delivery people?
No, that's Tinder or OkCupid.
Okay. Yeah, I guess.
See,
I mean, I'm sure you would come up with something.
Somebody please write an Airbnb folk horror story. I would love that.
Oh my God.
Actually, wait. I'm trying to think. There was one I read. It was one of the year's best. And it was about a couple using an Airbnb in England. And they had to leave a pat of butter in a specific spot for the gray people, they call them, or the fey people. And if they forget, something bad will happen. And they forgot, and their son goes missing. And the story ends with them trying to get him back, and they can't.
Oh, my God.
And they call this, I'm trying to remember, oh, it's going to drive me nuts. I'll probably look it up, and I'll put it in the story, in the podcast notes, because it was a really good one. And it just kind of just unsettled me a lot, because I've got a son who's a teenager. He's exactly like the kid in the book. He would have done the same things. And when he disappears, it's just like they all go out together. He decides to go on his own, then he never comes back. And they keep calling the Airbnb host and like, well, we told you to do it. We told you. It was good. Yeah, it's very folk horror, but in that kind of, it was really creepy.
But there's that ritual again, that yeah. Propitiatory ritual. Mm-hmm. Guess what happens if you don't follow the rules? Yeah. Oh my God. Ugh, that's so creepy.
Yes. A much better version of much better. There was some movie that came out recently too, I think last year, that was
Unwelcome.
Caps. It was terrible. Like living in their garden and they had to feed it blood. I'm like, oh, this reminds me of the short story, but not as good.
Yeah. I was about to say that was the exact premise of Unwelcome.
Unwelcome. Yeah. That was it. Oh God. That was, it had,
not great.
It was so uneven.
Yeah.
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 I keep thinking it. So I have a, I guess, folk horror, but also Weird West, but also Wild Hunt story coming out at some point this year with Absinthe Books. And I was talking about it on a podcast a little while ago. And it's like, where on earth did we as a people, as a species, get the idea that human sacrifice was going to help anything? And why is it so pervasive once it started? Like, you see it in many cultures, in many stories, in many myths, and it happens in this book, because they're like, well, this seems like a good idea. And I'm like, I am writing this story and I can't tell why you think it's a good idea. It's a very bad idea. And they're like, we don't care.
Yeah, I actually wrote about that.
I mean, ultimately, isn't that a good part of the Bible? I just think that's a thing that's happened in all cultures for as long as people have been around. And
yeah,
it is interesting to wonder what the logic was behind. Well, I'm having a bad day, so maybe killing this person will change the luck of that. Like, I just don't understand the way that your brain would work to get to that conclusion. But apparently it's the thing a lot of people throughout history came to on their own. So
for hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah. Isn't recent. This is literally as soon as we became humans, we thought it was a smart, good thing to do.
It lasted till very recently in a lot of cultures and stuff too, which is just, again, it's insane when you think about it. Although I always think it's funny, in the, speaking of the Bible version, the whole Abraham Isaac thing is like, psych, no, you don't have to.
Right. Well, and I think we still do that to a certain extent in society. It's just, it's fame. You know, we love to knock people down and sacrifice a person, or even at a company, there's one person that's got to take the fall for everything. You know, we're just not killing them now. Yeah. But that impetus is still there.
Not right away.
I think.
They said the main character, like what people used to call the main character of the internet. Oh, they're the main character of the internet today because they get like basically torn apart.
They're our scapegoat today.
Twitter is so full. That's one thing I like about Blue Skies. It seems less prone to that kind of mob rule attack. But Twitter, ever since like even the early days of Twitter, like even when it was calmer, there was still that viciousness. People loved it. Like, I remember one where there's like some woman who said something, she tweeted, got in the plane, turned off her phone, and by the time she landed, she was fired from her job. And people
To be
lost
fair, she was saying something like all Africans are going to get
Oh,
AIDS.
yeah, it was horribly
So
racist. It was
it
horribly racist.
was horrible.
Right. I
Yes.
remember that.
The fact that people loved going, like, it's just the joy people got from taking her down, though, was kind of
That's
like,
very folk horror.
yeah, it was just kind of
Like
like,
the
I mean, I get
mob.
it. She did what she did was wrong. She should have gotten fired, but the people watching it and stuff and whether like getting into it and like they're just loving it. It's just like, yeah, that's kind of messed up too.
It's
Like,
like not just the people that are putting the guy into the Wicker Man, but also everybody standing around watching
and
the
singing. Well,
flames
that's
and
the
eating
true
popcorn.
horror.
Like,
Yeah, that's the true horror is the mob mentality. You know, the lottery. It's all the people that go along with the idea. Because it's one thing to have the idea, but then when you've got a huge group of people that are all willing to go along with it, without questioning, you know, that to me is the most horrifying thing about all of those sort of stories.
The fan culture, I think, fandom, the way that some people are set up to be almost worshipped, and then the backlash that happens once they reach this tipping point, that also
Milkshake duck.
shows up. Yes, the milkshake duck. Exactly.
Or the Hugos recently.
Are the egos?
Yay. Oh my God.
Yay.
Yeah. I never heard about like what is somebody called the secret
The
fan?
Smoffs.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before. And I'm like, whoa, that's I guess. And then the more I read up on it, I'm like, holy shit, this has been like a thing since like the 30s and stuff. Like that's
Again, so there we've got our folk horror, the long memories, the rituals, the secret knowledge, the esoteric learnings that outsiders don't know, and the fact that they've declared themselves the secret masters of fandom. They're a cult. They're a cult. They're a folk horror cult. They probably sacrifice people.
We got into the cult without even realizing it. We joined up. Like,
I
yeah, we're
didn't
gonna
join
write
up.
these fun, cool horror things, yeah, and science fiction and fantasy. And like, oh no, what did we do?
Oh, actually, they actually did sacrifice people. I mean, we're finding that out now that they removed people from the slate. So there actually was a sacrifice to get good crops.
Not only was there a
God, this is
sacrifice.
messed up. I don't
Yeah.
know.
Yep. Oh, it's so bah. Man, we're gonna get some angry comments on this one. How dare you insult fandom? Anyway,
Sorry.
oops.
Sorry, we're not secret masters.
Yep.
It's also hard to talk about folk horror without getting political, when you start talking about in-groups and out-groups, and how that ties into the current kind of polarization of society and the way that people are being siloed, because of their internet communities and developing these parallel but very different set of beliefs where, people come together in real life and it's almost like we can't communicate because we're coming from different worlds and we might all be Americans or Canadians or whatever, but we're essentially living in different worlds and so it's hard not to get political and hard
I
not
think
to find
all
your
horror is political though, I think.
That is
And
true. Yeah, that's very
I think I
true.
would be hard pressed to think of horror that I've enjoyed that tried to be apolitical in some way. I don't think it's possible because it's always so much a product of its time and its place and the milieu in which we are trying to write. I mean, I hope that all art is political in some way.
I think it has to be in order to be successful. And that goes back to what you're saying, previously about the hippies and wanting to go back to the land and then the farmers having a problem with them. Like those were two groups of people that did not interact and could not get along and, just were unable to sort of understand each other. And here we are, now, and it's different. It's different, but it's the same. Like that's really ultimately everything stays the same. Human nature isn't that different from ancient times. Our technology gets better and we kind of evolve, hopefully, in more productive and meaningful and interesting, helpful ways, but not always. And
our brains
easy to get philosophical about it all.
I mean, at least we're not actually putting people into the Wicker Man. Like we're just metaphorically doing it.
That's right.
Right, but we don't know what, you know, some little island somewhere, you know, there could be some.
I'm not vouching for those island people. Well, they're probably doing one right now.
I don't know, though. I mean, because, like, when you look back, at least in the U.S., when you go back to the Trump's, like, when he was the first time he was, like, running for election, I mean, people were being murdered by his followers. Like, one woman got killed by somebody driving a car right into the crowd, you know? And, you know, I mean, usually in, like, you know, folklore, it's the liberals and the left that are, like, going on the murdering sprees, and it's the right Republicans that get murdered for it. Or not Republicans, but, you know, I mean, even Agent Howe, you could see he's more right of spectrum than left, you know, while the members of Wicker Man, even though they're looking back and archaic in a way, they're still obviously supposed to be hippies, you know. And I don't know, it just seems interesting that we're seeing that kind of reflection now, like even with the January 6th riots, like I can't remember, at least in the U.S. there are sacrifices.
For sure. I mean, there was one that just happened. If you look at the rhetoric and sort of the things that certain political groups gather way to other, and then you see how that poison spreads and infects other people who then react violently or get, you know, caught up in the propaganda of it all. It's causing, like, genuine, you know, crime and murders.
The whole pizza
thing. Great.
That demanded to see, like, where the child slaves are being held by Hillary Clinton in the pizza place.
Sure. There was no basement. Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's like the basement of the Alamo.
Right.
It was just invisible. We weren't worthy enough to know about the secret passage that, you know.
Yeah, it's scary to be in the U.S. right now, to be honest.
No, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
No, I'm moving back.
The gun violence. Oh, my God. Well, you know, when you enter, they'll hand you a gun. That's the rule now, you know.
That's the rule.
Hey, guns. It depends where you live. Yep.
You go through the metal detector, and it doesn't detect the gun, they hand you one. It's part of the, you know, point of entry.
All right.
And each year, you get a new one.
Yeah.
Yeah, NRA mandated it, you know, you come in. Unless, of course, obviously, if you're, like, from south and north of the border, then they're like, no.
You're, like, darker than a paper bag, then you don't get one. Yeah.
If you're speaking French, they're like, no. No. Sorry, Quebecois, no.
All right. Even the French, wow, getting harsh.
The Republicans are standing out against.
Just pretend to speak with a southern accent.
There you go. Well, I mean, the Republicans are standing out against the.
Well, French. I am from Alabama, so.
Well, there we go.
Because they're smuggling marijuana and stuff across the border, I guess.
The deadly marijuana.
You know,
so deadly.
Is it Reefer Madness again? Oh, no.
Well, it's Satanic Panic again. Why not bring back the Reefer Madness?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be extra funny because it's legal most places now.
Right.
Speaking of Satanic Panic, yeah, I mean, just I've been thinking so much about how all of this is cyclical. You know, it makes sense for folklore to come back now, you know,
alongside if things go in circles.
Satanic Panic.
Yeah. Even though, like, the D&D panic, is your kid playing D&D? It's so popular now, but it's so evil. It's a demonic gateway. I'm like, why am I seeing these ads on Facebook? What year is it? Like, I remember seeing this kind of thing in, like, 1988.
They're doing it again.
Oh, tarot cards, too. Demonic gateway. Big, big demonic gateway. Don't let your kids use tarot cards. I forget what else. There was a list.
My poor kids.
I should have screenshot it because I'm never going to see it again now.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's too funny because I raised my kids playing D&D and tarot cards and Ouija boards. And
stuff. Oh, well, they're probably possessed by demons now.
Yeah, they're 20s, so.
Oh, it's a guarantee. Yeah, you're done for.
That's okay. Demons are cool with me. We're good friends.
No, it is crazy and frustrating, though, because, you know, I grew up at the height of the Satanic Panic and had to deal with people, you know, parents being super susceptible to that sort of propaganda, and anybody that was different or strange was immediately, oh my gosh, my child is, you know, in peril. And to see that we've learned nothing now, and that it's just, like you said, cyclical, and it's just happening all over again. It really is just astonishing to me. Mm-hmm. Because it's the same thing. It's the same boogeyman. It's the same, all of it. And I don't know if somebody's deliberately just keeps trying to push their agenda, or if it's just, it's in human nature to make those conclusions in some capacity at some point about somebody. But it is just really objectively interesting, but personally terrifying.
Yeah, I grew up through that too. My dad, who was an atheist, thought that Satanists were trying to brainwash everyone still. And I said, but you don't believe it.
Wow.
I don't have to.
At least my parents were religious. Like, they made weird sense.
To be fair, my dad thought the Catholics were ruining the world too and brainwashing children also. So. Mm. But wow.
I went to Catholic school for 12 years and they tried to brainwash me really, really hard. So I get where that's coming from.
Yeah. Well, that's what he did too. He did too. But he thought the Satanists were worse because at least Catholics don't murder people. I'm like, do you, the Spanish Inquisition?
What?
You know, but you know, whatever.
Anyways, whatever.
Yeah, he burned my character sheet for D&D in the fireplace at one point. It was kind of, yeah. Yep. And then when
it got sacrificed.
When I was all goth in high school, he almost had a heart attack.
Yep.
What devil worshiping shit is this? I'm like, Dad, you listen to heavy metal. I mean, come on. He's like, but that's different. That's fun. Like, what is wrong with you? It's like,
and then we all grew up and became horror writers.
Yeah. It's like thrill kill cult. I'm like, you're listening to Slayer and Cannibal Corpse, and you would think that thrill kill cult and Nine Inch Nails is evil, but that's different. I'm like, I don't understand. I don't get it. Hopefully you don't listen to this, because they'll get a phone call. And how dare you air our dirty laundry of our family? Oh, no. But whatever, I'm leaving it in.
Right. Well, Satan probably told you to listen to the podcast anyway, right? So. that was demonic influence.
Oh, he's gonna love when my book comes out in October, I'll tell you what.
Oh, he's gonna love it.
Yeah, no, it's all about a group of Satanists worshiping a woman who's the Antichrist and stuff. So it's fun.
Oh, good.
Oh, nice.
More folk horror fun stuff. It's great. Yep, lots of murder. They're being chased by serial killers. It's fun. A happy story for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, him and like the Catholics in my family are going to freak out. I can't wait. It's so blasphemous.
What good is being a horror writer if you can't freak out your family?
Exactly.
Yeah, what's the point?
Yeah, they won't read my stuff. My parents are like, they're like, I don't understand horror. I don't get it. I don't understand it. My dad's like, Stephen King, he's garbage. Why are you reading that garbage? It's garbage in, garbage out. And I'm like, the garbage pays. I mean, not a lot right now, but it pays.
Right.
It's not Stephen King money, but still.
One day.
Money. Yes. Yeah, I'd be fine if I didn't. That's okay. I don't want his habits that came with all that money.
Yes.
He did write some very interesting books during that time, though.
That's true.
Not condoning it, but.
Yeah, that's the thing. Most people think that his drug years were things like Tommyknocker and stuff, which they were, but like also Cujo and.
Pet Cemetery.
Yeah, Pet Cemetery and stuff. So. The Shining. I guess we can't do a horror podcast without bringing up the name of the man himself.
That's like a prerequisite. He has to be mentioned.
We got pretty far before we brought it up. Yeah,
that's true.
I'm actually surprised we didn't tie in Pet Cemetery to folklore.
Well, I can bring it around because In the Tall Grass, I think, is folklore, and that was based. That's a Stephen King story.
Children of the Corn.
Children of the Corn.
Yeah, totally.
And Pet Cemetery. Pet Cemetery is definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the ritual, the earth itself being the enemy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't read Into the Tall Grass, though. I've been meaning to.
Oh, you should. It's really good. It's one of his darkest stories, recently speaking. Yeah, you need to read it.
Was that the one he wrote with Owen Hill?
Was that
Yes, Joe Hill. And they made a movie on Netflix, too. So if you don't have the time to read, at least watch the movie.
I saw the
Owen
movie.
King, that's what I meant to say. Yeah. Owen King, not Owen Hill. How do they change their name? Joe Hill. Cool. No, I've got it. I've actually got it. I need to read it. I'll just read it. It's short too. So yeah. So it's kind of interesting. I think that we were actually talking about a majority of this about folklore by way of shorts, by way of a story that doesn't exist, that we're just kind of brainstorming together. And I think that probably illuminates a lot of folklore better than if we had just sat and talked about it completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking before about like how we want to move this past the home county horrors, because that's where it seems to be situated a lot these days. And that was one of the things I heard about some people, a podcast from two guys in England criticizing The Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched for being an American production and daring to like go beyond home county's horror. Book horror wasn't that. I thought that was kind of a weird thing to say. And it made me think that, you know, actually, like going back, folk horror has kind of been like a multicultural thing for a long time. I mean, as long as there's like some sort of old religion to draw from, there have been stories where it comes into conflict with like modern day society. And I'm just trying to think, because like even like there's like some old Japanese like short stories and stuff. I'm trying to remember the name of some of the writers, and it's escaping me. I think it was the guy who wrote The Hell Screen had one. That was somewhere, oh, it was him, or maybe it was Edgar Allan Poe, I don't remember, but had something similar to it. It's just, it seemed odd that he said that. And I'm assuming everyone here doesn't think that, you know, it's only for England.
Yeah,
not at all. And I've actually seen quite, especially now, there's been quite a few movies that are foreign, that I think, that are foreigners and they're not American made, that I think are really good examples of folk horror. Probably more so than some of the U.S. made movies that I've seen recently. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about stories so much off the top of my head, but I know that I've read some.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, movie-wise, Oxhead Village, that was one I was thinking, yeah, that's really good.
Huh. And to think that it's just, it's mostly English or American, I just, like, I don't even know who would that's a...
They were mad that Americans were doing it. They thought Americans should not do it.
I heard about that.
Yeah. They like Americans shouldn't be doing it because their country's too young. They don't understand.
Yeah, they don't have a long enough history.
They shouldn't be done anywhere else. And I'm like, that's a weird thing to say. Because all their religions come from somewhere else. So they don't have the history and the ground. And I'm like, I don't know, because I would say definitely The Willows is a folklore story, and that's like very much situated in America, you know. Or American.
And also, there are
Dark and Days Bewitched. Like, if you look at all the movies that they selected, it's like a wide variety.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Which is why it's great, I think. And why it's, I think, definitely like, somebody said before that, like, they're wondering why it's becoming current now. And I'm wondering, too, if like it's part of something in the air, or also, too, it's like a lot of Congregationalist, because I think I remember Mark Gatiss did like The History of Horror, and that's where it was kind of first mentioned and kind of became popular. And then it didn't become huge right then, but it started snowballing, and it, like, more and more things started following and stuff. And then it became like this, it's like a buzzword now, you know.
Yeah.
It's definitely its own subgenre now. But I'm wondering if it's like something in the air, if it's just like it was just kind of accruing after a while, and more people became interested, and it just kind of picked up speed and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. I think the idea too that, the idea that only England, because it has this ancient history, should be allowed. Like, why wouldn't there be old gods and ancient cults everywhere? Like, that's a very strange idea. You know, there have been human beings in North America for tens of thousands of years. You know, we've got Aboriginal groups that have been here everywhere. The place wasn't empty when the settlers showed up. Like, I just... That's a very strange thing for them to say, you know, that it's too new. No, it's as old as everything else.
I think it's because Americans, like the colonizers, were the ones making it.
Oh,
that was their complaint, which is kind of
not exclusively. No,
yeah,
England is like the biggest colonizer in the world.
They're like, but it shouldn't be the colonizers. It should be like Native Americans making the folklore. That's what they were saying. It was a very, very weird thing to listen to.
Yeah, this seems like a weird chain of logic.
So strange.
Yeah.
And then
well,
they started calling like any folklore that wasn't from England exotic. And I'm like, so you're calling Americans racist for not letting Native Americans make folklore, but then you're calling stuff like anything not from America or not from England exotic. It's very,
okay.
it's very,
That's
I
very
listened
weird.
to it yesterday, like, oh, this is about folklore. I'm going to listen to this now. I'm like, oh my God, what is this even?
Yeah, the gatekeepers confuse me because even the people who are kind of like the big experts, the big names in folklore, like Adam Scoville, you know, who outlined the folklore chain, and the folklore revival guys who run that account and have published a lot of writing. If you'd ask any one of them, not a single one of them would claim that folklore is a British phenomenon. I think British folklore is its own distinct thing because it deals a lot with like English identity and the conflicted feelings that they have about their own, you know, culture that was very unique to that particular period of time in the 60s and 70s because of what was happening, you know, within the UK and the collapse of empire. So I agree that British folklore is a very unique thing, but that doesn't mean that those themes don't translate to every single culture in the world. So I really don't get the gatekeeping. And, you know, a lot of American folklore, even if it's made by, you know, white people and the descendants of the settlers, it's often that kind of self-reflective grappling with the different cultures in the US that are bumping up against each other and, you know, the issues that that creates. And also, I mean, there's absolutely folklore that is being made by, you know, indigenous people. You know, one of the most kind of successful examples in recent years was the novel by Stephen Graham Jones, The Only Good Indians, which is an excellent example of folklore, you know, in written, he's a member of the Blackfeet tribe. There's been an anthology of short fiction recently, Never Whistle at Night, which is all indigenous stories. So it's very recent. It's still very new, you know, that these things are getting awareness, but they do exist and it's only going to get better, you know, now that folklore is a buzzword and people are realizing that it doesn't have to be standing stones and druid robes and, you know, these very British kind of, you know, quaint English villages in the countryside. So it's changing. It's getting better, I think.
Yeah. And I think that part of it is that historically we've been exposed to a certain type of folklore because those were the people that had the opportunities to make it. It doesn't mean the other stuff wasn't existing. It just wasn't being given the same audience and attention. And now that hopefully we're, you know, all a little bit more cognizant of that and of the history and the varied amount of mythology and stuff that we just were never sort of granted access to by people in charge of stuff, we're going to see a lot more, you know, and it's exciting. But to say that it's always existed, most of all of the most interesting myths and stories to me are ancient and they're not American based. So to sit there and that whole argument is just so strange to me.
It is.
Because it's not taking into account that there was people making those decisions. It wasn't like we had any say in it. And culturally, of course, the majority of the movies were going to be from, you know, like the colonizer's perspective because they were the people in charge of everything.
And making the canon too, you know, not just the stories, but deciding what counts.
That's exactly. That's my point. It's just, it's so silly to sit there and criticize that when it's like, of course that we all know that was the reality, but it doesn't mean that was the only thing that existed. It's just, that was the only thing being given the opportunity to be shown to us.
Remy, you said you have to leave in a little bit?
Yeah, like 5:30. So
Okay. Yeah. Is there if we still keep talking after you're gone, or if like I don't know, it's up to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we can. So yeah, whenever you go, just let us know, and then we'll just continue on. So that way, people at home will know. Yeah, a lot of me talking this stuff out, obviously. But yeah. I mean, I agree. I think it was a very weird, narrow-minded thing to say. Especially they criticize like American folklore as dealing too much with like witches and Protestants and stuff. And I was like, that's strange, because like the Vavitch and like other things like that. I'm like, yeah, but I mean, if you're going to include Witchfinder General, then you're going to have to be include those movies. So it's like, I don't know. It was a
That's
very
like
strange moment.
criticizing the Crucible, or it's just the culture that makes the things their stuff, their the stories are going to reflect the history that they know about. If they had decided, if some filmmaker 30 years ago decided to make some Native American movie about Native American myths, some white dude, they'd be criticizing that because it wouldn't be accurate, which they should rightly criticize that. But it's just like, it's a no-win situation to sit there and criticize the thing that was just, it was the way it was.
It would be
And the
really.
movies that got made were the movies that got made. And, you know, it's just, it's so strange. I just find that so peculiar.
It
And
was.
maybe I'm not eloquently explaining
No, you're absolutely right. It would have been,
it's just,
yeah. It would really
yeah.
funny if they would have made that argument and said, like, you know, Crazy Horse or Dances with the Wolves was American folklore.
Right.
But yeah. So what? I guess another really good question, but and we'll start with Premi because she has to leave soon. What brought you into folklore first?
I think reading it first, like I didn't see the Wicker Man movies or anything like that till I was a bit older. But a lot of those older horror stories, like I was talking about, you know, Arthur Machen and Algernon Blackwood, and even some of the M.R. James stories were kind of my introduction into it. So I had this idea in my head of what folk horror was before I knew that it was a term. So yeah, my introduction to an interest in it is very much coming from that sort of historical perspective, and also where it, like we said, kind of bumps up against cosmic horror because they have so much in common. It's just a type of horror that really appeals to me, because of the tropes that we've been talking about, you know, the juxtaposition and the in-group, the out-group, and the that deceptive rural landscape. Yeah, it's kind of it's every folk horror is kind of a complex little puzzle box of a story in a way that things like slashers or like other movies like that kind of don't feel to me.
Stino, how what got you first in the folklore?
I don't think that there was any specific thing. I've just always been sort of reading horror in some capacity, like my entire life. And I just think there was something about those particular stories that appealed to me. Maybe the pagan aspect, or the idea of there being secret cults, and you know, just all the tropes of them. They were just fascinating. And then as I got older and read more stuff and saw, like Premi was saying, how much it bumped up against cosmic horror, which was my other favorite thing, you know, it was just, it's been delightful to sit there and delve into all the stuff that I've missed over the years because it wasn't really my focus. And there's so much out there. And it's been really exciting seeing all the newer movies and stories that are coming out too. So I think it's a rich vein and has so much potential. And every story I read, it has similar aspects to it, but they're all so wildly different and interesting. And they give you these little glimpses of cultures, you know, imaginary or based in historical fact, but it's just all windows into worlds that you're not usually sort of privy to. And then usually they do terrible things, and it's a lot of fun and entertaining as hell to read. So
All right, Rowan, same question.
It's a combination of things. I mean, I've always been a horror fan. And, you know, when I was younger, I was really into fantasy. So, you know, what Stina was saying about this window into other worlds and cultures, you know, I think that that kind of resonates with me as well. I was also a huge kind of Anglophile and obsessed with Ireland and Irish mythology and the Druids. When I was younger, and you know, feeling a bit jealous of the kind of ancient history of you know, England, and visited there a lot. And so I think, you know, when I saw stuff like The Wicker Man when I was in college, you know, it kind of combined a lot of that, you know, those old things that I you know, loved when I was much younger, and kind of feeling that sense of re-enchantment, you know, kind of reconnecting with this sense of the magical and the spiritual in nature, especially since I live in a big city right now. It's really hard to find. So yeah, it's just the culmination of a lot of things. And then the pandemic, as I mentioned before, really brought it to a head to me, that sense of isolation and that sense of wanting to go outside when you can't go outside. And thinking about the way that isolation affects people and communities and their view of the world.
With me, like Premi, it's when I was a kid, I read a lot of like classic horror. I was given like a book of classic horror by my grandma because she knew I was really big into horror, and like Arthur Machen's The White People, I was obsessed with. Like I read that story like repeatedly over and over again. Just something about like talking about the Troy Towns and like the Green Book and all that stuff, I just loved it. And so like later on, I started going, when I went to the library, they had this collection of books there called Man, Myth, and Magic, the Encyclopedia of Man, Myth, and Magic. Yeah, I was so obsessed with that book, like those books. I actually own a copy. I bought a copy a few years ago, so I have my own collection. And so
yeah, I have a whole set too. They're amazing.
Yes, it's just pure folk horror bliss. And so like when I'd never seen The Wicker Man or any of the other movies, and then I watched Mark Gatiss' History of Horror, and he started talking about folk horror. And I'm like, yes, that's the stuff that I like. And so like I watched The Wicker Man, I'm like, yes, more like this. And then I watched like Blood and Satan's Claw and Witchfinder General. I'm like, well, maybe not those two. And so it was like that same, like it was interesting because it's just like it's something I've been looking for but not having a name for the longest time. And then when I finally got a name for it, it was just exciting.
Right. That's true. And that's true for my situation too. When I was reading all these different books, I didn't know that there was a name for that particular flavor of stuff. So, and yeah, to know that it was a whole genre, it was really exciting. And, you know, there's no way to possibly read everything, but I'm going to try.
It was like, yeah, he's able to find like all this stuff now that you didn't even know was there. It's like, oh, I've been waiting for this for so long and now it's here. Yeah, but I remember even like when I was in high school, I like stole a few books from the library that were similar to Man, Myth, and Magic.
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioning that, I never would have connected that, but that definitely helped with the fascination and why I was so drawn to those. And vice versa, they probably inspired a lot of my then, you know, going and searching out more folk horror, because it was just this giant compendium of all these different cultures and rituals and magic and stories and everything. So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think one book, it was something like Magic of the British Isles or something like that. It had a corn dolly on the front of it, and it was like amazing. Like, and it was like Man with the Magic, where every single page was illustrated with photographs and everything. And I remember one, I don't know how true these were. I think they might have been some of the people on the islands making fun of the anthropologists, asking them questions. Because one of them was talking about Scottish Highland sheep tenders and how they had their crooks and everything. And so they would say that they were magical. And one of them said, like, mine's magical because there's a live bee inside of it, and that's where my magic comes from. And I thought, that's so cool. And now I'm like older, I'm like, that guy's probably messing with them. I'm like, no, I swear, yeah, that's what's in here. Or that guy was like the guy on the documentary that's like, I will never go where the cocks don't crow. He's a little like that guy. I don't know. But yeah, I was obsessed with that stuff. And then I found out there was a whole wealth of movies and books based on it. It was just exciting.
Yeah, I remember getting excited when I saw, I think, Wakewood come out in 2009. You know, that was a little before the term folklore started getting used.
Yeah.
But I recognized it immediately as being, you know, like that kind of thing. I mean, it's not the greatest movie, but, you know, it's good. You know, it's not bad. But especially at the time, you know, after having discovered The Wicker Man and being like, oh, I need more stuff like this, you know, and then seeing Wakewood in 2009 and be like, yes, there it is again. You know, and now since, especially since like maybe 2015, there's just been such an avalanche where they called it a micro genre as recently as 3 years ago, but now I can't even keep up with, you know, what's coming out that's getting called folklore anymore.
Yeah. I think you might be right that the pandemic kind of accelerated it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you said that earlier, you're talking about like the isolation and stuff. I think that really kind of made folklore go from being like this little niche thing to being like everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think it was interesting too, because I remember going to see Hereditary and thinking it was going to be a ghost, like a just regular haunting kind of ghost movie. And then all of a sudden I started realizing, wait a minute, this is folklore. They've got all
Yep.
the Paimon and all that. So I'm like, huh, that's kind of cool. And so when Midsommar came out, I was like, oh, cool, he made another one. I'm like, wow, it was a movie.
Yeah.
I yeah, it was, I honestly think Wakewood's a little better than Midsommar.
Oh, bold, yeah.
I know, I know. The imagery in Midsommar is kind of interesting, but as a movie, I don't know. It's.
Yes, I have to see that one.
Oh, well, some people don't like Wakewood that much. I remember one review called it shake and bake religion at the core of it. And I'm like, that's an interesting way of putting it, but yeah, I guess. But I liked it a lot. It's very Pet Sematary.
Yes.
Ooh.
Pet Cemetery meets The Wicker Man, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that sounds intriguing. I'll check it out.
Yeah, and then I think the same director also did another movie called Red Tree, I think, something like that. And that was okay. I thought Wakewood was slightly better. They're both kind of.
Wasn't Wakewood also the first film of the revived Hammer Studios or something like
I
that?
think so. Was it that one or was it the Woman in Black? Which one was the
Not
first
sure.
one?
Okay.
Yeah. Because I know, yeah, it was Wakewood.
Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
Wakewood, Woman in Black, and Let Me In. We're all around the same time. And they're all. And Hammer's doing more movies now, too, thankfully, after being quiet again for a while. Yay, Hammer.
That's cool.
So I'm trying to think, like, what's maybe it might be a good time to start ending this. It's starting to get slowing down the conversation a little. Any closing remarks on folklore? I know Premi had to leave a little early, so she's not gonna be able to say anything, but just any thoughts on where you think the future of it is going to be? Like, is it still gonna be like a big thing in a few years, or is it gonna be like grunge music and just kind of subsumed into regular horror?
I think it's always going to exist. I think there might be it might be a fad right now to make a plethora of movies right now, because like you guys were saying, I do think the pandemic definitely played a part in all of it. But the ideas behind and the motivations, just the whole meaning and the subtext and layers of all the folklore, like they're not going anywhere. There's always going to be those things existing. I think it's really fascinating how many things can fit under that umbrella, and we didn't even get into it, but I even think some of like the fairy tale-y type movies have definite folklore aspects to them, and those are some of my favorite movies. So I guess I'm hoping that we get some more of those as opposed to just the traditional folklore. But I think it's going to stick around. There's no way to. It's been, you know, almost what, like, when was The Wicker Man? The 70s, and I would say there's probably even some you know, before that that could be possibly called such, but. It's not going anywhere.
I think our understanding of what it is going to keep evolving. You know, the folklore chain was only defined in like 2015, and people are still arguing about the definition, you know, what counts and what doesn't. And with the huge popularity that it has right now, I think, you know, the bigger the audience gets and the more people, you know, in the more diversity of people who are creating folklore stories, the definition is going to evolve. You know, 10 years from now, we might be calling stuff folklore that we never would think now would count. So I think that, you know, that's going to crystallize at some point, and there, it's going to be more settled. And there, you know, more people will be able to kind of agree on what is folklore and what counts. And so I think once that happens, then, you know, no, it's not going anywhere. And to me, the folk aspect is so important, like folklore and folk tales and folk music. And that's always, it always has been, you know, a part of horror, you know, that's what most monster movies are, right? You know, legends, local legends come to life. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think that the hype, you know, might die, you know, and people might get tired of using the term, but the elements themselves are not going anywhere.
Yeah, I personally see it probably being like cosmic horror, where it doesn't really go anywhere. It just evolves and changes. It may go in and out of fashion at certain points, but, you know, at least with folk horror, we don't have it tied to like one person, like cosmic horror is with Lovecraft. Because like there's like a whole bunch of just stuff with that, you know, all this racism.
I'm happy because I don't think that that's necessarily the case anymore. I think there's been enough new blood into that to where we can sit there and say, yeah, he's, you know, maybe the one that created the genre, but it's such a bigger beast than him now. And I think folklore will be the same way, whereas like the Wicker Man's always going to stand as the example of, you know, the epitome of what it is, but it's going to continue to evolve. And I like that it's never really being settled, and I hope it doesn't get settled. I would hate for it to just be, well, if it has 1, 2, 3, 4, then that's considered folk horror and anything else isn't. Because I love that there are so many different ways that you can interpret those, and that there's folklore, mythology, all of the, everything just comes down to story ultimately. And stories are the one thing that we've always shared and, you know, told to one another. So I'm looking forward to seeing how folk, quote unquote, and mythology, quote unquote, evolve now, and our new myths and all that, how that gets incorporated into a new generation of what we would consider folklore.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you said before about it going more towards the fairy tale folklore aspect. And I think that's interesting because like right now, there's a lot of people who focus mostly on folk being evil as the aspect of it, you know, and I think that goes back to the Unholy Trinity, because those movies, the main thing they have in common is that people act evil towards other people, you know.
Right.
Used to be. And I'm liking that it's moving more like towards folklore and folk stories and things like that, and moving away from like people are evil and they suck. But I mean, those are good stories too. I think that's so limiting and what folk horror can be, that I'm hoping it moves away from that. And that's what I like about Wakewood, actually. It's really interesting because like they don't, it's like if you had the Wicker Man and like, you know, instead of like Christopher Lee murdering people, he's like, hey, let me help you bring your daughter back to life. Just follow these rules. And if you don't, then oops.
Yeah.
She's going to murder you.
See, and I love that because that's sort of the same tropes and things of the old school fairy tales. And I had a thought and I totally lost it, but it's just I totally lost my thought.
Like your own flaws, right? Are kind of what's going to bring you down.
Or like there's the rich.
Right. Or how I'm excited that it's not going to be just about humans are bad. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many other stories that don't necessarily have to even involve human monstrosity, where it's like, I'm trying to think of a way to word this, but it's like, there's always been an element of the fantastical in folk horror. It kind of has to do with magical thinking or magical, traditions or just magic in general or gods and goddesses. And the idea that that's just a half step away from like fairies and changelings and all of that is exciting to me, because I think since it's always been sort of a weird offshoot of fantasy in my mind, if you could blend all of that in, but of course it won't, because we need a way to quantify it, but I just hope there's more fantastical quote unquote folk horror, mm-hmm. Where you have these belief systems, and maybe instead of just people believing that they're magical, they actually are magical. I just think that would be interesting.
Yeah, that's what Wakewood is, basically. It's like that. And it's interesting too, because like the ritual in it, it's very similar to folklore and fairy tales, you know, where there it's like, you do this, you follow these rules, and, mm-hmm. you know, this will happen. And of course, the rules always get broken. You know, that's just how it is.
Right.
But I mean, that's the ritual and that sort of thing, and keeping with the tradition is like a key part of folk horror, I think, too. So even if you, like, it's just interesting to me how that works. Especially with Wakewood, when you compare it to Wicker Man or like some of the other ones where like the traditions are more like, we're going to murder you, you know, or like The Apostle. That was another one that was very much like that, similar. Because it's a very, very manly man movie, similar to True Detective in that way.
Well, I don't know if it's too late in the conversation to bring this in, but
you can keep going.
Reminds me a little bit of I recently read a scholarly work by, I think it's Don Keatley, who mm-hmm. does a lot of research and writing about folklore in particular. And she published something recently called Folk Gothic.
Ooh.
And it's kind of proposing the idea that there's a distinction between folk horror and folk gothic. Folk horror is more outwardly horrific, where, you know, there's a lot of violence and, you know, the focus is on, you know, the kind of living, breathing folk who are attacking the protagonists in a very direct, horrific way. You know, and that would be like The Wicker Man and Midsommar, where you've got these recognizable people who are, you know, actively perpetuating the horrors. Folk gothic is more kind of focused on threats coming from the land itself, or these kind of sacred artifacts that you have unearthed, like the M.R. James type stories. And I think that there's probably a lot more potential in the folk gothic for different kinds of stories, because it doesn't rely on, you know, ooh, creepy cult doing ancient rituals. You kind of have a lot more leeway for what Stina was saying, like the fantastic and the focus on the lore and the fairy tales and all of those kinds of things. So I find myself thinking about that a lot, like the folk gothic and the kind of forces that are permeating the landscape itself. And that is going, you know, kind of into cosmic horror territory again. So there's so much overlap.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that term. I like it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I actually kind of prefer that.
Yeah, I think that's more my style of folk horror, actually, is the more gothic elements.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. Oh, it's funny thinking about, like, you know, the people do evil folk kind of folk horror. I was just thinking about like the recent variation on the ones who walk away from the Omelas that came out. And how they were talking about, like, oh, the child was sacrificed, and it wasn't like, you know, a metaphor. It really did stop all these like tornadoes and earthquakes and stuff. And I'm like, that's actually kind of folk horror, isn't it? Like, it's like, what if the work ended and they're like, you know, oh, we let him go. Oh, crap. And now everything's gone to shit.
Yeah. I haven't actually read it. I feel so bad. I haven't read The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas yet. I have a tab. It's on one of my tabs that is open. But it does sound.
I haven't read it either. I'm just familiar enough with it to where, yeah, I kind of know what the gist of it is. But yeah, I need to read it too.
I actually haven't read the short story. I remember it's like really short, though. It's more like a thought piece.
It's like 4 pages, I think.
Yeah, but somebody did a riff on it, and that's what made me think of that.
Right.
I hadn't read the original, but I know the gist of it. But then I read the riff on it, and it was basically, what if we killed the kid in the hole? That's, I think, the title of it. It was basically about, like, what if they murdered the kid that was in the homeless hole, and what would happen and stuff, so... And I was talking about earthquakes and everything else and fires. And I'm like, huh, that'd be like, what if they let Agent Howie go? And then like all the bad shit happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's going back to that whole idea of the scapegoat that we were talking about earlier in our conversation.
Yeah, I wonder why, you know, actually, because I remember Premi talking about like how, like, you know, this human sacrifice is always part of our culture and stuff like that. And why is it there? And I'm wondering if that has something to do with like the whole scapegoat thing. I wonder how that ties in to like this idea of folk horror and like, you know, the need to sacrifice in order to make things right or things like that. It just, there's something.
I think it's an evolution of what was that they had back in the day too, the sin eater, where they would, you know, use somebody in the village as the sort of the collection of all of their bad.
Yeah, like, what was it? It was like a Jewish thing where they would take a goat. Oh, yeah, right. It was a literal goat. That was the scapegoat. And put all their sins in the goat and then, like,
set it
free. That's, yeah. It's interesting. I wonder. It makes me wonder about the bitch, though. And how that, like, comes into the folk or evil stories and things like that. Because it's like, if you focus entirely on folk horror being folk or evil, then that throws out a lot of the movies and books and everything else that are considered folk horror these days. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if folk gothic is just a better term for it, because folk horror has come to mean specifically one thing with a certain group of people. Like all the American movies are kind of like about that, you know?
Oh, and I was just going to say, even the witch or the witch, I'm never quite sure how to say it, but that could even be considered folk gothic, I think. Mm-hmm. That speaks to like a very Puritan kind of thinking of the land is evil. Mm-hmm. You know, the dark woods are where the evil spirits live, you know, and if you kind of get too close to nature, then these kind of evil spirits will infect you.
Oh, that Hawthorne kind of stuff, Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Exactly.
Yeah, Young Goodman Brown. All that fun stuff. There is actually one movie that I've been meaning to watch. It's on Shudder, and I keep forgetting the name of it until I rewatch the documentary. And I'm like, oh yeah, that one, Eyes of Fire. And I keep meaning one of the, but it's also kind of similar. It feels like it was a proto version of the Vavitch.
Yeah.
But it looks, have either of you seen it?
No, I haven't.
I've seen it. It's a very odd movie. And it's, you know, very low budget 1980s kind of feel, like very goopy and visceral.
Interesting.
I don't know how to describe it. You just have to watch it, but you should watch it. It's an interesting film.
Well, what gets me is always the little scene that they put in the Woodlands, Darks, and Days Bewitched documentary, where it's like this woman voiceover while they're going through the prairie and talking about how they're going to find paradise and stuff. And the voiceover always interests me because it reminds me of the one in Badlands. Just the way the tone of it and stuff, or like something about the dreamy aspect of it made me think of, what was that Australian movie? Picnic at Hanging Rock. What you said, it sounds nothing like that. So never mind. Maybe it's just that clip.
It's very different. But yeah, you're right. It does. The whole movie does have a very dreamy.
Oh, it does. Good. Yeah. That's what I want to watch. Okay, good. I want that kind of stuff because I really like Picnic at Hanging Rock. I like that. And Badlands kind of has that too. That dreamy kind of, not exactly surreal, but things are just kind of like in a haze almost.
Yeah.
And it's goopy, you said. Interesting.
It's a very
goopy
strange.
And hazy.
Yeah.
A goopy dream. So goopy in like what way? Like as in oh geez. As in a reanimator kind of way?
Like, I don't know. Just the something about the special effects. You know, they do a lot of practical effects. I don't want to make comparisons because my memory of it has sort of quickly faded about the details.
Oh, that doesn't work well.
Yeah. No. I think it was just like I didn't know quite what to make of it.
Okay.
When I first saw it, so it wasn't like an immediate "I love this," but it was like, "Huh, okay." But it definitely does visit a lot of the same kind of territory as The Witch, with, you know, the woods are this evil place, and you know, very very American kind of attitude towards nature, I think.
Conquer it.
Yeah, exactly. Got to tame it.
Yep. Okay. I definitely have to watch that then later. Yeah. Cause I rewatched Woodlands Dark and Debut, which I love that movie though. I've got yes. The DVD or no, the Blu-ray. I've got the Blu-ray and it's got all the special features that I've watched like a billion times. You'd think a 3-hour movie would be enough. But all the extras are so interesting too.
Yeah. I still have to, I watched it originally when Shudder had it all. And then I bought the box set, but I have not revisited it because it's so daunting. When I open it up, I just see all these movies and I'm like, well, I have to watch all the movies then.
Wait,
and I have to watch all the special features.
You got the Severn box set?
Yes.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. It's amazing. Just the booklet alone is almost worth the price. I know it's like exorbitantly priced, but yeah, right. They have it on sale for like half off sometimes, like occasionally. So it's a good time to snatch it up.
But you know what though? I paid like $200 for the complete Encyclopedias Man, Myth, and Magic. So I'm sure eventually I'll have enough money to get that too. I got to feed my full core addiction.
You do. See, I lucked out with the Man, Myth, and Magic in my library. Right before I moved out of California, was having a Friends of the Library sale, and they were selling them each for, I think, either 50 cents or $1 each, and it was the whole set. So.
What?
Yeah, so I got it all. God. I was very happy. It was, you know, it was like 10 years ago probably now, but yeah, I was thrilled.
Yeah, I think I got mine in 2015, 2016, and it was like, I sold the short story, and I'm like, ooh, that's enough money to get this finally, and it was on eBay, but the condition was
it's awesome.
Yeah. I kind of wish it would have gotten out of the library though.
I lucked out. It was one of the best scores at the time that I had ever stumbled upon. I was like, oh my God. And I was sure that when I was looking at it, I was like, there's going to be one volume missing and I'm going to be so mad. Mm-hmm. And I sat there and looked and checked and they had it all. And I was like, okay, this is so mine.
So cool. Okay. And now with that, I think it's about time to wrap it up. Check in again soon. In a few more months, we'll probably be having a new podcast, this one involving cosmic horror, and that'll be fun. And I've got a few more lined up after that, so stay tuned and check back soon. And thanks again for all my guests for coming here today and discussing folk horror with all of us. All right, have a good night and a fearful evening, listeners.